The Castle. Just as Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse detrains, some rakehill hits him full in the face with a turn of brackish ice water. The barrage continues as he walks a gauntlet of bucket-slinging ne'er-do-wells, but then he realizes no one's there. This is just an intrinsic quality of the local atmosphere, like fog in London. The staircase that leads over the tracks to Utter Mowbray Terminal is enclosed with roof and walls, forming a gigantic organ pipe that resonates with an infrasonic throb as it is pummeled by wind and water. As he walks into the lower end of the staircase, the storm is suddenly peeled away from his face, and he is able to stand there for a moment and give this phenom the full appreciation it deserves. Wind and water have been whipped into an essentially random froth by the storm. A microphone held up in the air would register only white noise, a complete absence of information. But when that noise strikes the long tube of the staircase, it drives a physical resonance that manifests itself in Waterhouse's brain as a low hum. The physics of the tube extract a coherent pattern from meaningless noise. If only Alan were here. Waterhouse experiments by singing the harmonics of this low fundamental tone, octave, fifth, fourth, major third, and so on. Each one resonates in the staircase to a greater or lesser degree. It is the same series of notes made by a brass instrument. By hopping from one note to another, Waterhouse is able to play some passable bugle calls on the staircase. He does a pretty decent reveille.
Oh, how lovely!
He spins around. A woman is standing behind him, lugging a portmanteau the size of a hay bale. She is perhaps 50 years old. With the physique of a stove. And she had a nice new big city permanent until a few seconds ago when she stepped out of the train. Salt water is running down her face and neck and disappearing beneath her sturdy frock of gray tagum wool.
"Ma'am,"
Waterhouse says. Then he busies himself with hauling her portmanteau up to the top of the stairs. This puts the two of them, and all of their luggage, on a narrow covered bridge that leads across the tracks and into the terminal building. The bridge has windows in it, and Waterhouse suffers a nauseating attack of vertigo as he looks through them and through the half inch of rain and salt water that is streaming down them at any given moment towards the North Atlantic Ocean. This major body of water is only a stone's throw away and is trying vigorously to get much closer. This must be an optical illusion, but the tops of the waves appear to be level with the plane on which they're standing, despite the fact that it's at least 20 feet off the ground. Each one of those waves must weigh as much as all of the freight trains in Great Britain combined, and they are rolling towards them relentlessly, simply hammering the living daylights out of the rocks. It all makes Waterhouse want to pitch a fit, fall down, and throw up. He plugs his ears.
"Are you a bandsman, then, I take it?"
the lady inquires. Waterhouse turns to look at her. Her gaze is darting back and forth around the front of his uniform, checking the insignia. Then she looks up into his face and gives him a grandmotherly smile. Waterhouse realizes in that instant that this woman is a German spy.
Holy cow!
"Only in peacetime, ma'am," he says. "The Navy has other uses now for men with good ears."
"Oh!" she exclaims. "You listen to things, do you?"
Waterhouse smiles. "Ping, ping," he says, mimicking sonar.
"Ah,"
she says.
"I am Harriet Quitt."
She holds out her hand. "Hugh Hughes," Waterhouse says, and shakes.
"Pleasure."
"All mine."
"You'll be needing a place to stay, I suppose."
She blushes ostentatiously.
"Forgive me. I just assume you are bound for outer."
That's outer, as in outer tagum. Right now, they are on inner tagum.
"Quite right, actually,"
Waterhouse says. Like every other place in the British Isles, inner and outer tagum represent a gross misnomer with ancient and probably comical origins. Inner tagum is hardly even an island. It is joined to the mainland by a sandbar that used to come and go with the tides, but that has been beefed up with a causeway that carries a road and the railway line. Outer Tagum is 20 miles away.
"My husband and I operate a small bed and breakfast," Mrs. Quirt says. We should be honored to have an Asdic man stay with us.
Asdic is simply the British acronym for what Yanks refer to as sonar, but every time the word is mentioned in the presence of Alan, he gets a naughty look on his face and goes on an unstoppable punning tear. So he ends up at the Quirt residence. Waterhouse and Mr. and Mrs. Quirt spend the evening huddled round the only source of heat, a coal-burning toaster that has been bricked into the socket of an old fireplace. Every so often, Mr. Quirt opens the door and pelts the ashes with a mote of coal. Mrs. Quirt ferries out the chow and spies on Waterhouse. She notices his slightly asymmetrical walk and manages to ferret out that he had a spot of polio at one point. He plays the organ. They have a pedal-powered harmonium in the parlor, and she remarks on that. Waterhouse first sees Outer Tagum through a scupper. He doesn't even know what a scupper is except a modality of vomiting. The ferry crew gave him and the other half-dozen passengers detailed vomiting instructions before they fought past the utter Mowbray breakwater. The salient point being that if you leaned over the rail, you would almost certainly be swept overboard. Much better to get down on all fours and aim at a scupper. But half the time when Waterhouse peers down one of these, he sees not water but some distant point on the horizon, or seagulls chasing the ferry, or the distinctive three-pronged silhouette of Outer Tagum. The prongs, called sigras, are basaltic columns. This being the middle of the Second World War, and Outer Tagum being the part of the British Isles closest to the action of the Battle of the Atlantic, they are now flecked with little white radio shacks and hairy with antennas. There is a fourth sigra, much lower than the others, and easily mistaken for a mere hillock, that rises above Outer Tagum's only harbor, and indeed only settlement, not counting the naval base on the other side. On top of this fourth sigra is the castle, that is the nominal home of Nigel St. John Gloamthorpe, Wodemeyer, and that is to be the new headquarters of Detachment 2702. 5 minutes' walk encompasses the whole town. A furious rooster chases a feeble sheep down the main street. There is snow at the higher elevations, but just gray slush down here, which is indistinguishable from the gray cobblestones until you step on it and fall down on your ass. The Encyclopedia Tagmiana has made much use of the definite article. The town, the castle, the hotel, the pub, the pier. Waterhouse stops in at the shithouse to deal with some aftershocks of the sea voyage, and then walks up the street. The automobile pulls up alongside and offers him a ride. It turns out to be the taxi, too. It takes him round the park, where he notices the statue. Ancient Tagmians thrashing hapless Vikings. This gesture that does not go unnoted by the taxi driver, who veers into the park to give him a better look. The statue is the sort that has a great deal to say and covers a correspondingly large expanse of real estate. Its pedestal is a slab of native basalt, covered on at least one side with what Waterhouse recognizes from the encyclopedia as Tagmian runes. To an ignorant Philistine, these might look like an endless random series of sans-serif X's, I's, V's, hyphens, asterisks, and upside-down V's. But it is an enduring source of pride to... We didn't care for those Romans and that Julius Caesar fellow, observes the taxi driver. And we weren't too taken with their alphabet either. Indeed, the Encyclopedia Tagmiana features a lengthy article about the local system of runes. The author of this article has such a chip on his shoulder that the thing is almost physically painful to read. The Tagmian practice of eschewing the use of curves and loops, forming all glyphs out of straight lines... far from being crude, as some English scholars have asserted, gives the script a limpid austerity. It is an admirably functional style of writing at a place where, after all the trees were cut down by the English, most of the literate intellectual class suffered from chronic bilateral frostbite. Waterhouse has rolled down the window so that he can get a clearer view. Apparently someone has lost the squeegee. The chill breeze washing over his face finally begins to clear away his seasickness, to the point where he begins to wonder how he should go about making contact with the whore. Then he realizes, with some disappointment, that if the whore has half a brain in her head, She's across the island at the naval base. Who's the wretch? Waterhouse asks. He points to a corner of the statue where a scrawny, downtrodden loser with an iron collar welded around his neck and a chain dangling from that quivers and quails at the carnage being meted out by the strapping Tagmian He-Men. Waterhouse already knows the answer, but he can't resist asking.
Hark!
Blurts the taxi driver, as if he is working up a loogie.
He is from Inner Targum, I can only suppose.
Of course.
This exchange seems to have put the driver into a foul and vengeful mood that can only be assuaged with some fast driving. There are a dozen or more switchbacks in the road up to the castle, each one glazed with black ice and fraught with mortal danger. Waterhouse is glad he's not walking it, but the switchbacks and the skating motion of the taxi revive his motion sickness. The driver says, when they are about three-quarters of the way up, and nothing has been said for several minutes.
They practically laid out the welcome mat for the Romans. They spread their legs for the Vikings. They're probably Germans over there now.
Speaking of bile, Waterhouse says, I need you to pull over. I'll walk from here.
The driver is startled and miffed, but he relents when Waterhouse explains that the alternative is a lengthy cleanup job. He even drives Duffel up to the top of the Sigga and drops it off. Detachment 2702 arrives at the castle some 15 minutes later in the person of Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, USN, who is serving as the advance party. The walk gives him time to get his story straight, to get himself into character. Chatton has warned him that there will be servants and that they will notice things and that they will gossip. It would be much more convenient if the servants could simply be packed off to the mainland for the duration, but this would be a discourtesy to the Duke.
"You will," Chatton said, "have to work out a modus vivendi."
Once Waterhouse has looked this term up, he agreed heartily. The castle is a mound of rubble about the size of the Pentagon. The lee corner has been fitted out with a functional roof, electrical wiring, and a few other frills, such as doors and windows. In this area, which is all Waterhouse gets to see for that first afternoon and evening, you can forget you are on Outer Tagum and pretend that you are in some greener and balmier place, such as the Scottish Highlands. The next morning, accompanied by the butler, Giddix, he strikes out into other parts of the building and is delighted to find that you can't even reach them without going outside. The internal connecting passages have been mortared shut to stanch the seasonal migrations of skerries, the frisky, bright-eyed, long-tailed mammals that are the mascot of the islands. This compartmentalization, while inconvenient, will be good for security. Both Waterhouse and Ginnix are encased in plank-like wrappings of genuine Tagum wool, and the latter carries the Galvanic Lucifer. The Galvanic Lucifer is of antique design. Ginnix, who is about 100 years old, can only smile in condescension at Waterhouse's U.S. Navy flashlight. In the sotto voce tones one might use to correct an enormous social gaffe, he explains that the Galvanic Lucifer is of such a superior design as to make any further reference to the Navy model a grating embarrassment for everyone concerned. He leads Waterhouse back to a special room behind the room behind the room behind the room behind the pantry, a room that exists solely for maintenance of the Galvanic Lucifer and the storage of its parts and supplies. The heart of the device is a hand-blown spherical glass jar comparable in volume to a gallon jug. Giddix, who suffers from a pretty advanced case of either hypothermia or Parkinson's, maneuvers a glass funnel into the neck of the jar. Then he rustles a glass carboy from a shelf. The carboy, labeled Aqua Regia, is filled with a fulminant orange liquid. He removes this glass stopper, hugs it, and heaves it over so that the orange fluid begins to glug out into the funnel and thence into the jar. Where it splashes out onto the tabletop, something very much like smoke curls up as it eats holes, just like the thousands of other holes already there. The fumes get into Waterhouse's lungs. They are astoundingly corrosive. He staggers out of the room for a while. When he ventures back, he finds Ginnix whittling an electrode from an ingot of pure carbon. The jar of aqua regia has been capped off now, and a variety of anodes, cathodes, and other working substances are suspended in it, held in place by clamps of hammered gold. When Ginnix gets his carbon whittled to just the right size and shape, he fits it into a little hatch in the side of this bowl and casually throws a Frankensteinian blade switch. A spark pops across the contacts like a firecracker. For a moment, Waterhouse thinks that one wall of the building has collapsed, exposing them to the direct light of the sun. But Ginnix has simply turned on the galvanic lucifer, which soon becomes about 10 times brighter as Ginnix adjusts a bronze thumbscrew. Crushed with shame, Waterhouse puts his navy flashlight back into its prissy little belt holster and precedes Ginnix out of the room, the galvanic lucifer casting palpable warmth on the back of his neck.
"We've got about 2 hours before she goes dead on us," Ginnix says significantly.
They work out a modus vivendi, all right. Waterhouse kicks an old door open, and then Ginnix strides into the room that is on the other side and sweeps the beam of the lantern around as if it were a flamethrower, driving back dozens or hundreds of squealing skeddies. Waterhouse clambers cautiously into the room, typically making his way over the collapsed remnants of whatever roof or story used to be overhead. He gives the place a quick inspection, trying to gauge how much effort would be required to make it livable for any more advanced organism. Half of the castle has, at one point or another, been burned down by a combination of Barbary corsairs, lightning bolts, Napoleon, and smoking in bed. The Barbary corsairs did the best job of it, probably just trying to stay warm. Or maybe it's just that the elements have had longer to decompose what little was left behind. In any case, in that section of the castle, Waterhouse finds a place where there's not too much rubble to shovel out, and where they can quickly enclose an adequate space with a combination of tarps and planks. It is diametrically opposed to the part of the castle that is still inhabited, which exposes it to winter storms but protects it from the prying eyes of the staff. Waterhouse paces off some rough measurements, then goes to his room, leaving Ginnix to see to the decommissioning of the galvanic lucifer. Waterhouse sketches out some plans for the upcoming work, at long last putting his hitherto misspent engineering skills to some use. He draws up a bill of required materials, naturally involving a good many numbers. 108-foot 2x4s is a typical entry. He writes out the list a second time, in words, not numbers. 108-foot 2x4s. This wording is potentially confusing, so he changes it to 2x4 boards, 100 count, length, 8 feet. Next, he pulls out a sheet of what looks like ledger paper, divided vertically into groups of 5 columns. Into these columns, he transcribes the message, ignoring spaces. 2x4 boards, 100 count, length 8 feet. And so on. Wherever he encounters a letter J, he writes I in its stead, so that joist comes out as I-O-I-S-T. He only uses every 3rd line of the page. Ever since he left Bletchley Park, he has been carrying several sheets of onion skin paper around in his breast pocket. When he sleeps, he puts them under his pillow. Now he takes them out and selects one page, which has a serial number typed across the top and is otherwise covered with neatly typed letters like this. ATHOPCOGNQDLTUICAPRHMULEP, and so on, all the way down to the bottom of the page. These sheets were typed up by Mrs. Tenney, an aged vicar's wife who works at Bletchley Park. Mrs. Tenney has a peculiar job which consists of the following. She takes 2 sheets of onion skin paper and puts a sheet of carbon paper between them and rolls them into a typewriter. She types a serial number at the top. Then she turns the crank on a device used in bingo parlors, consisting of a spherical cage containing 25 wooden balls, each with a letter printed on it. The letter J is not used. After spinning the cage the exact number of times specified in the procedure manual, she closes her eyes, reaches through a hatch in the cage, and removes a ball at random. She reads the letter off the ball and types it, then replaces the ball, closes the hatch, and repeats the process. From time to time, serious-looking men come into the room, exchange pleasantries with her, and take away the sheets that she has produced. These sheets end up in the possession of men like Waterhouse, and men in infinitely more desperate and dangerous circumstances all over the world. They are called one-time pads. He copies the letters from the one-time pad into the empty lines beneath his message. When he is finished, 2 out of every 3 lines are occupied. Finally, he returns to the top of the page one last time and begins to consider the letters 2 at a time. The first letter in the message is T. The first letter from the one-time pad directly below it in the same column is A. A is the first letter in the alphabet, and so Waterhouse, who has been doing this cipher stuff for much too long, thinks of it as being synonymous with the number 1. In the same way, T is equivalent to 19 if you are working in a J-less alphabet. Add 1 to 19 and you get 20, which is the letter U. So, in the first column beneath T and A, Waterhouse writes a U. The next vertical pair is W and T, or 22 and 19, which in normal arithmetic add up to 41, which has no letter equivalent. It's too large. But it has been many years since Waterhouse did normal arithmetic. He has retrained his mind to work in modular arithmetic, specifically modulo 25, which means that you divide everything by 25 and consider only the remainder. 41 divided by 25 is 1 with a remainder of 16. Throw away the 1, and the 16 translates into the letter Q, which is what Waterhouse writes in the second column. In the third column, O and H give 14 plus 8 equals 22, which is W. In the fourth, B and O give 2 and 14 equals 16, which is Q. And in the fifth, Y and P give 24 plus 15, which is 39. 39 divided by 25 is 1 with a remainder of 14. Or as Waterhouse would phrase it, 39 modulo 25 equals 14. The letter for 14 is O. So the first code group looks like T W O B Y A T H O P U Q W Q O. By adding the random sequence A T H O P onto the meaningful sequence T W O B Y, Waterhouse has produced undecipherable gibberish. When he has enciphered the entire message in this way, he takes out a new page and copies out only the ciphertext, U, Q, W, Q, O, and so on. The Duke has a cast-iron telephone, which he has put at Waterhouse's disposal. Waterhouse heaves it out of its cradle, rings the operator, places a call across the island to the naval station, and gets through to a radio man. He reads the ciphertext message to him letter by letter. The radio man copies it down and informs Waterhouse that it will be transmitted forthwith. Very soon, Colonel Chatton, down in Bletchley Park, will receive a message that begins with UQWQO and goes on in that vein. Chatton possesses the other copy of Mrs. Tenney's one-time pad. He will write out the ciphertext first, using every third line. Beneath the ciphertext, he will copy in the text from the one-time pad. UQWQO ATHOP. He will then perform a subtraction where Waterhouse performed an addition. U minus A means 20 minus 1, which equals 19, which gives the letter T. Q minus T means 16 minus 19, which equals negative 3, giving us 22, which is W, and so on. Having deciphered the whole message, he'll get to work. And eventually, 2x4's 100 count will show up at the pier.